It's really important that we stand here for the voices of the immigrants and for the people who are standing in line, feeling scared, feeling attacked.
This is part of the Bush administration's really attack on civil rights, and immigrants are the first target.
Does diplomacy matter at all, or are the ideologues prepared to go it alone despite whatever opposition exists?
This case was litigated without Mr. Hamdi ever having an opportunity to rebut the allegations against him. In fact, my belief is he doesn't even know there was a case.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, January 13th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. allies, including the British and the French, have sided with U.N. Weapons Inspection Chief Hans Blix and International Atomic Energy Agency Chair Mohammed al-Bahardi over the past week. Their stance that the inspectors need more time for their investigations before determining whether Iraq presents a threat and is likely to weaken the U.S. war effort and delays attempts to launch an attack in early February, as had previously been suggested. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Phyllis Bennis, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, about the possible implications of these latest developments.
The latest developments have to do with the inspectors, both the nuclear and chemical and biological inspectors, saying that they need more time for their inspections to be completed. They say they want up to a year for inspections, and that puts a serious crimp in the expectation of the Bush administration that they would be prepared to get UN support for a war in Iraq this spring, specifically before, say, mid-February, when the temperatures in Iraq begin to rise. The expectation is that because there have been other statements from other countries, most significantly Britain and France, that the inspectors have to be given all the time they need, that this will make it very difficult for the U.S. to win international opinion, international support for going to war right away.
Well, does it seem like the Allied support for this war is starting to wane a bit or dwindle? The Britain and France have said they also need evidence of any wrongdoing on the part of Iraq, and we know that they're also asking that the U.S. return to the Security Council for a resolution before endorsing the use of force and having it made formal that there was indeed a material breach.
I think that it's really more an example of the countries that were already opposed to going to war gaining a certain confidence and a certain willingness to go public with their opposition because of the growing understanding that the inspectors are simply not finding, not only they're not finding a smoking gun, they're not finding a gun at all. And because of that, I think the countries that were already opposed to war, such as France, such as Germany and others, are prepared to make their opposition more public. Turkey has pulled back from its earlier, more open-ended willingness to give the U.S. access to its bases and its land. The Saudis have made very clear that its cooperation depends on there being a second UN resolution. All of these developments, but most importantly, the fact that the inspectors are simply not finding anything.
Well, when this whole business about there's no smoking gun, which Blix said earlier, or he said that last week, that there's no smoking gun, does that prove that there's Iraqi noncompliance, or does it mean that there is no smoking gun?
I think it means two things. One, it means that the inspectors have gone wherever they've wanted. They have not been impeded. The Iraqis have allowed them full and unimpeded access, and they've found nothing. That's one part of the no smoking gun notion.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, which is perhaps even more important, is that the U.S. has made claims over and over again that it knows for sure that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, not programs to make them, but the actual weapons. And yet, even though Colin Powell claims that the U.S. has given the U.N. inspectors some of the information, some of that intelligence information documenting the existence of such alleged weapons, to which Mohammed al-Bahardi, The head of the IAEA actually denied that and said they have not received any such information yet. Maybe Hans Blix has. But the key is, even with that information in hand, and presumably going to the places the U.S. tells them are the sites of these alleged weapons, they're still finding nothing. What that says is either the U.S. is lying outright about what information they have, or the U.S. definitions of what constitutes a weapon is simply not the internationally accepted definitions of what weapons are.
But the U.S. also seems to be trying to interpret this lack of any evidence, if you will, or no smoking gun, as a clear and strong case that, aha, Iraq is not complying with this.
That only works if you accept the legitimacy of the U.S. claim that there are weapons of mass destruction, and if the Iraqis are refusing to say where they are, then they're not cooperating.
So is Hans Blix and the rest of his team, are they accepting that?
Not yet. They are saying, if you have evidence to the United States, if you have evidence, give it to us and we'll check it out. Whatever the U.S. is giving them, they're checking it out and it's not panning out. They're not finding anything.
Mm-hmm.
So far, this U.S. claim that we know they have these weapons, and if they're not telling you where they are, it means they're not cooperating, is not borne out on the ground.
And so we see this January 27th deadline date, at which point Hans Blix is supposed to report back to the Security Council.
It's a deadline that was written into the language of the resolution that says that the inspectors must report back by that date, and they will indeed report back. I have every indication that their report will be very similar to the interim report they gave last week, in which they said that there is no smoking gun, we found no evidence of weapons of mass destruction, there are some remaining questions that Iraq needs to answer. Iraq has said it will answer additional questions, and the heads of the two agencies, Mohammed al-Baradi and Hans Blix, are heading back to Baghdad next week to raise those questions with the Iraqis. That's all that I would anticipate we will hear again on the 27th. The question is, what's being lowered is the diplomatic temperature around the United Nations and within the international community overall.
So, in your opinion, Phyllis, how does this look overall in general, if you had to sum it up in terms of the Allied support at the UN?
I think right now there is dwindling support. It is lower than perhaps it's ever been in a more public way right now. The danger is that as the U.S. goes forward with sending tens of thousands of troops to the Gulf, aiming at a deployment of 150,000 troops in the area in and around Iraq, the question then becomes, does diplomacy matter at all? Or are the ideologues in the Pentagon and around the Bush White House prepared to go it alone despite whatever opposition exists? That's a very serious danger that we in this country have to take very seriously.
Phyllis Bennis is a senior fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. For almost a year, a U.S. citizen has been held incommunicado without access to legal counsel. He's being held solely on the word of one of the northern warlords of Afghanistan. Apparently last February, Yasser Asimhamdi was captured in northern Afghanistan. He was purported to have been fighting with the Taliban. To date, he has not been charged with any crime and is held without the benefit of habeas corpus. A U.S. citizen born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Hamdi sits in a military brig in North Fork, Virginia.
It came to our attention when it was listed in the newspaper that a person that had been taken into U.S. custody in Afghanistan and had been moved to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, had been brought to the Eastern District of Virginia, where I'm the public defender. We assumed that he was brought here for purposes of prosecuting him, since he was an American citizen and had been arrested or detained by U.S. military at or about the same time that John Walker Lind had been detained, and he was ultimately prosecuted in this district.
Go ahead. We know that John Walker Lind was actually fighting with the Taliban. What was Mr. Hamdi doing that earned him the title of enemy combatant?
Nobody knows at this point, except what basically happened was, because we defend indigent criminal defendants in the Eastern District of Virginia that are charged in federal court, we attempted to make contact with Mr. Hamdi, and that ultimately led us into the situation where we were told that there was no foreseeable plan to prosecute him, but that we couldn't see him because he was an enemy combatant, which led into the case that just recently came down from the Fourth Circuit. We filed a habeas corpus petition on Mr. Hamdi's behalf, and we were never allowed to see him, so we really don't know what his story is.
You, to this day, you've not spoken with him directly?
No, we've not been allowed to.
And yet you're representing him?
Well, yes. I mean, we were appointed by the court when we filed the habeas corpus petition on his behalf. I mean, we were not allowed to go in to see him. He was being held incommunicado. We filed a habeas corpus petition that would hopefully have allowed us to go in to see him. And it was that habeas corpus petition that led to the most recent decision of the Fourth Circuit.
I thought it was one of the most basic tenets of constitutional law that a person was allowed to see their attorney.
Well, basically, the Fourth Circuit has ruled that because of the tension between the president's war powers and the Article III powers of U.S. courts, that in matters relating to the prosecution of a war, the president has almost absolute authority, and that a court can order a person in Mr. Hamdi's situation to see a lawyer. So ultimately, this case was litigated without Mr. Hamdi ever having an opportunity to rebut the allegations against him. In fact, my belief is he doesn't even know there was a case.
And so what is likely to happen to him?
Well, he is likely to be held indefinitely until the government concludes that its war on terror is over. In solitary confinement in a Navy brig.
So he's not, I would assume, not been able to contact his family members either.
He has been able to send them a letter or letters, but they haven't been very informative.
Well, have you attempted to write him?
Yes. I sent him, you know, like a testing letter here. You know, I've been appointed to represent you in this case. Please let me know if you receive this letter. Enclosed is a stamped, self-addressed envelope. Just write yes or no and return it to me. And I never got a response.
So it's your belief that what? It was intercepted?
It's my belief he's not getting mail from counsel. I mean, if you look at the Padilla case in up in New York, the government has filed affidavits explaining why, if somebody like me is allowed to talk to this individual, it will interrupt their efforts to build a dependence of him upon his intelligence handlers. And it then will interfere with their ability to interrogate the man and get information out of him. So they've been very strong that these enemy combatant types should not see lawyers.
Mm-hmm. And as an attorney, what's your concern here? I mean, it seems like a total suspension of the constitutional rights that are normally afforded an individual. What's the path that we're headed down here?
Well, my concern is that, of course, in the heat of battle, you don't want to be serving papers on the sergeant while the smoke is still coming out of the cannon barrel, so to speak. On the other hand, we also know that in the heat of battle, snap decisions are made, which means that mistakes can be made. So after the dust is cleared and a person is like Mr. Hamdi, he's a U.S. citizen, he's on U.S. soil, it seems to me under those circumstances somebody ought to be able to open up the can and see what's in it. And certainly Mr. Hamdi should be given an opportunity to read what the government says about him and say whether it's true or not. I mean, if what the government says about him is true...
And what is that? What they're saying?
They're saying that he was operating with a Taliban unit that came into conflict with a Northern Alliance unit and was turned over to the U.S. authorities by the Northern Alliance. Now, we all know these warlords in Afghanistan. They can't be trusted. They switch sides. They're interested in graft and drugs. We think that Mr. Hamdi should have an opportunity to know what the U.S. government is saying about him and to refute it if he can. Mr. Hamdi was born in the United States, which gave him U.S. citizenship, but then at a very early age moved with his family to Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So while he's technically an American citizen, he's not Americanized. Mm-hmm. His father claims that he was there doing charitable relief work for victims of the war. The government has a different view, but we've not been able to get Mr. Hamdi's side of it before the court because the Fourth Circuit has basically said that when the government says what happened, that's what happened. You cannot challenge it.
Now, is that a new tone on the part of the court, or are there any other cases that have set a precedent here that might be
considered?
Well,
there are no precedents on this point. There is a case from World War II, Torito, where the prisoner of war challenged his status as a prisoner of war, and he did get access to counsel, and he did get a full hearing on the merits of his case. But that's the only case like this one.
So they can just indefinitely detain an individual without access to counsel. And when do they intend to charge him with anything?
Well, we don't know, but we believe the reason that they didn't charge him with anything initially, why they didn't charge him, treat him like a second American Taliban, like John Walker Lynn, is because they had no evidence.
Is there any concern for his actual physical well-being, emotional health?
Well, you know, I don't know because they haven't made public exactly how these interrogations go. But it's clear that it's not limited to just going in and asking questions, that they are trying to get a psychological grip on these people that will make them perhaps more forthcoming. But at the present time, nobody really knows what this means. I think that the Fourth Circuit tried to draw a line and say that this power to designate people as enemy combatants and hold them without trial, without access to lawyers, incommunicado, that applies only on a foreign battlefield. And I guess my concern is that some of the language in the opinion might be used to expand the scope of that situation so that it would actually be used on the streets of Chicago, or L.A. or Washington or anywhere here in the United States where somebody that is not viewed by the administration as completely loyal to the United States and perhaps giving aid to a perceived enemy could be swept up off the street without charge, without lawyer, without any rights whatsoever, designated an enemy combatant and held in jail forever. That's my concern. I think the Fourth Circuit saw that possibility and tried to narrow its opinion so that it could not be used as authority for such a power, but yet there is language within the opinion that somebody could expand upon in kind of an extension of logic and use it to try to argue for such a scenario, and I just hope that doesn't happen.
And when you argue it before the Supreme Court, will you use a different argument?
No, the argument in the Supreme Court will be much the same argument that we used in the Fourth Circuit, which is that Congress has not suspended the writ of habeas corpus, and that what we have received so far in the Hamdi case has not been a meaningful habeas corpus proceeding because Mr. Hamdi was excluded from it totally.
Frank Dunham is the federally appointed attorney for Yasser Essam Hamdi. On Friday, the deadline for men and boy nationals of 10 countries were required to report to the INS. The event was fraught with disarray and confusion. Journalists from around the country continued to chronicle the chaos. Peace Watch spoke with Karim Shura, legal advisor for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee.
There are a lot of problems with the INS being able to handle this program, especially under the deadlines imposed on it by the Department of Justice. And so most of which actually is publicity. There was no publicity done on the part of Justice Department to inform individuals who were subject to these guidelines of the changes in the law, of the requirement for them to register.
So I'm hearing stories about individuals, particularly under the first scheduled deadline in L.A., who were detained on the spot to the point where they ran out of enough plastic handcuffs to actually detain these individuals with.
That's correct. That's exactly what happened in Los Angeles specifically at the date of the deadline. And so if you were there voluntarily, completely lawful, wanting to abide by the requirement and continue to be lawful, and you were not processed at the time by the Los Angeles office, no matter what your status is, you were detained until your status was determined by investigations, by the Justice Department.
Is the ADC representing any of these individuals?
We're not representing individuals. We did file a class action lawsuit along with three other civil rights organizations and six individuals who were detained in California, challenging the detention of individuals when they volunteer to abide by the law.
Mm-hmm. And so basically what has happened to these individuals that were detained because the office closed and, you know, on the day of the deadline?
Most of them were actually released. Many were released on bond. Some were not released. Some continued to stay in detention until today. The official line is that people who were detained when the office closed, they had to go through basically a procedure in order to verify their status. That procedure, officially at least, takes up to 72 hours. However, we have heard of stories of people who were detained for over a week.
Mm-hmm. And are these individuals given access to attorneys and their families?
Well, they're supposed to have, exactly, they're supposed to have access to their attorneys and families.
And they do?
As far as we know, most of them do.
When is the ADC's legal argument going to be submitted, and when will we hear a result from that?
Well, our class action lawsuit was already filed in Los Angeles, actually in Santa Ana, California, in federal court. That was filed back on December 24th. However, I don't have a scheduled court date yet.
Mm-hmm. So how do you, as an individual, someone who has worked with the ADC and you're familiar with the law, what is your personal response to this whole action?
I mean, basically what this amounts to is the wrong answer to a very serious question or to a very serious problem. The one reason that's given by the Justice Department is this is to protect our nation's security. And my immediate reaction is, it doesn't protect our nation's security. The answer from the INS is that the terrorists who attacked us on September 11th, many of them, three or four of them, I believe, did walk into an INS office and walked straight out the front door without being identified. And we could have prevented this if we had perhaps identified them somehow and verified their status and their identity. And so we need to think proactively as a country instead of retroactively, and not focus on people just because of where they come from. The terrorists have proven time and time again that they can recruit people from all ethnicities, from all nationalities, to carry out their evil deeds. If we look at the terror incidents or terror suspects that were picked up after September 11th, that would solidify this argument. Richard Reed, who's a British citizen, would not be subject to this kind of a program. John Walker Lind, U.S. citizen, is not subject to that kind of a program. Jose Padilla, who was arrested in Chicago, could have easily carried out an evil attack against our country. He would not be subject to such a program.
Karim Shura of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. In San Francisco last week, over 18 peace organizations held emergency solidarity actions outside the INS building. On Friday, a rally and press conference brought as many as 1,000 to the streets in front of the building in an effort to prevent further detainments of Middle Eastern immigrants in the second round of the INS special registrations. Pauline Bartolone and Sarah Olson were there and filed this report.
We are saying we refuse to have these people vanished from among us. We will remember who they are. We know their names. We know they exist. And we are calling for justice for them.
FBI, no more detentions, no more lies.
Shelja Patel, along with hundreds of others, demonstrated in San Francisco on Friday, not only to remember the thousands of Arab Americans that have disappeared since 9/11, but to show solidarity with the immigrants who have been called into a special INS registration process. Linda Sharif of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, or the ADC, calls the process a racist policy that leads to the detention of thousands of Middle Eastern men in the U.S.
Basically, INS is requiring men over the age of 14 who are from certain countries, predominantly Middle Eastern countries, to come in and special register if they're here on non-immigrant visas. When they come in, they're being fingerprinted, they're being questioned, they're being asked the same questions over and over again. A lot of times, they're actually being fingerprinted several times over again. And unfortunately, a large number of these men are being detained. A lot of times, for reasons that are the INS's own causing. For example, someone who has submitted paperwork to the INS in a timely manner in order to be here with proper legal status, and because INS is backlogged and it hasn't kept up with its job responsibilities, that person becomes out of status.
The special registration of visa-holding immigrants is in three phases, each one requiring immigrants from certain countries to register by three separate deadlines. The first deadline, last December 17th, resulted in the detention of upwards of 500 Middle Eastern men in Southern California who went into the INS for special registration and were immediately arrested. Bay Area activists responded by organizing 1 week of events outside the INS building to provide support for immigrants registering for the second deadline, January 10th. The INS refuses to release information about how many of those registering are being detained and refused to publicly address the issue. Nura Erekat from INS Watch stood by the doors of the INS building to monitor the registration process.
We're doing the job that the INS isn't doing themselves, which is cataloging how many people are coming into special register and how many people are coming out, and trying to make that information public so that we know how many folks, in fact, they're detaining. Those that don't come out, we try to follow up with them, basically to see how many people are being detained, because otherwise they're just missing.
First, I'm not a terrorist. I don't want to be identified to terrorists, and I don't want to be treated like a terrorist. I'm a man, I have human rights. I'm the country who's supposed to be the country of freedom, the freedom land, and it's not.
As Mehdi, a Tunisian immigrant, entered the San Francisco INS building, he expressed anger at the government-mandated special registration process.
I'm from Tunisia. I came here to study. I'm going to school. And I don't really want to finish school. I think that I'm going back to my country next week. They will respect me. I have an honor. And I'll have my rights. Here I have nothing.
Ningún ser humano es ilegal. Ningún ser humano es ilegal.
But even facets of the city government are against the INS special registrations. San Francisco.
Name of terrorism.
Yuri Kuchiyama is a Japanese-American civil rights activist. She has firsthand experience with government repression in the name of terrorism. She was instrumental in relating the current experience of Arab and Muslim immigrants today to the experience of Japanese Americans during World War II.
As one of 120,000 Japanese Americans that 60 years ago during World War II, we were the ones that were uprooted, evacuated, and incarcerated in remote places in America. We do not want that ever to happen again to anyone else.
Mark Vanderhout of the National Lawyers Guild has represented those accused of terrorism since the mid-80s. He says that the treatment of those in the first round of the INS special registration demonstrates the larger issue of violation of civil rights.
There's no justification whatsoever for many, many of the people who have been arrested. Many of the individuals who have been arrested have applications for permanent residency on file. The INS is already aware of them. They have permission to work. They're authorized to be ill. And there's no justification for their arrest whatsoever.
No human being is illegal. Ningún ser humano es ilegal. We must keep resisting, keep fighting, and never give up. Thank you, people.
With Sarah Olson, I'm Pauline Bartolone for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Averna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.